Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carl J. Mayer, one of two attorneys representing plaintiffs in a lawsuit challenging the indefinite detention provision of the National Defense Authorization Act, who talks about a recent court victory that could overturn the law. Pat Hunt, an organizer with a coalition that protested the NATO summit in Chicago, who discusses the week of actions and the reasons behind what appears to be a revival of the nation's long-dormant peace movement. And Gary Holder Winfield, chair of the Connecticut General Assembly's Black and Hispanic Caucus, who assesses the state's recently passed landmark education reform bill that some see as a model for the nation. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 10 days of Occupy Wall Street-style protests in downtown Moscow, police cleared out Christie Purdy Park, where activists set up a camp in the midst of protests against Putin's inauguration for his third term as Russian president. In early May, the camp had become a mini-democracy preserve, with lively open-air debates, music, and outdoor theater. Police cleared the park with a court order declaring the anti-Putin encampment failed to maintain public decorum. Some Russian analysts wonder if the camp of youthful protesters may have prompted President Putin to cancel his trip to the G8 meeting at Camp David. Before the camp was broken up, 20,000 people marched in Moscow to support the anti-Putin encampment. Before the crackdown, opposition leader Sergei Davidis noted, "Everyone underestimates the energy of popular protests. A lot of people thought it would calm down after Putin's inauguration. People are finding new ways to express their civil opposition. In the pro-Putin Duma or parliament, debate has begun on legislation to impose stiff sanctions on unauthorized protests, including a $50,000 fine against protest organizers. Few expect these new measures to intimidate young anti-Putin activists." Since the world sank into deep recession in 2008, economic cooperatives have emerged to provide a proven alternative to market failures in places as diverse as coffee growers in Kenya to the Rust Belt in the United States. According to the news magazine In These Times, an estimated 1 billion people are members of cooperatives, producing earnings equal to the gross domestic product of Canada. During the Great Depression, cooperatives were launched in the housing and manufacturing sector. Later, co-ops gained popularity during the 1960s, when many community health food outlets were founded. When the Occupy Wall Street movement was born last fall, activists tapped into the United Nations International Year of Cooperatives, with organizers calling for the new protest movement to create an economy worth occupying, as many promoted the cooperative business model. One of the most famous examples of successful worker cooperatives in the world is found in the Mondragon region of Spain, which has survived Spain's economic turmoil. But the cluster of worker enterprises has now created two forms of membership, diluting the ability of workers to vote their co-op shares. In Argentina, where occupied factories were transformed into cooperatives in the early part of the decade, enthusiasm has waned as co-ops seek legal status. Economist Gar Alperovitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism, has urged the Occupy movement to move beyond street protests to create new independent institutions, including worker-owned cooperatives. In Chicago, Occupy activists have joined with the United Electrical Workers Union to buy the Republic Windows and Doors factory that was famously taken over by its workers after owners shut the plant down in 2008. Kayla Booz was a happy 9-year-old in New Orleans when her father was convicted of killing another man in a barbershop fight. Once her father was sentenced to a Mississippi jail, Kayla's life fell apart as she grew angry and her grades declined to the point she was in danger of dropping out of public school. Now 17, Kayla was saved by a mentor, Brenda Williams, who helped the African-American teenager stay in school. The mentor closely monitored Brenda's schoolwork and met with her principal. Brenda was matched with Kayla in 2009 through a federally funded faith-based program called Mentoring Children of Prisoners, or MCP. Across America, there are over 2.7 million children of prisoners. According to the Pew Center, among African-American families, one out of every nine children has a parent in prison. The federal mentoring program was started in 2003 by the Bush administration. The program, funding both religious and secular groups, initially had a $49 million annual budget until last September, when all funds were cut by Congress. During its 8 years, MCP connected over 100,000 children of prisoners with mentors. Surprisingly, many of the mentoring programs continued despite the loss of federal funds, which were used for training and screening of volunteers. Now, as mentoring programs struggle to survive, new sources of funds and volunteers are being sought in America's inner cities. But the religious organizations and civil society groups that are stepping up to sustain a program with an impressive record of success are facing challenges, given that the jailed parents and their children have little or no political power or influence. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zofia Hunter.
On December 31, 2011, President Obama signed the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, which carries several ominous provisions. However, Section 1021 of the NDAA is the most alarming in that it empowers the current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens and non-citizens who were part of or substantially supported al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. Persons accused under this provision can be held by the U.S. military indefinitely or transferred to any nation in the world without charge, trial, or access to an attorney. Two lawyers, Carl J. Mayer and Bruce Affron, filed a lawsuit on January 13, 2012, on behalf of seven high-profile plaintiffs challenging the legality of what they assert are unconstitutional provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act. Plaintiffs in the case, known as Hedges v. Obama, include former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and America's most well-known dissident and linguist, Noam Chomsky. On May 16th, Federal Judge for the Southern District of New York, Catherine Forrest, issued a preliminary injunction that bars the U.S. government from applying indefinite military detention under Section 1021, finding that the law violates rights of free speech and due process. Your reporter spoke with Carl J. Mayer, one of the two lawyers who filed the NDAA lawsuit, who talks about his recent court victory and the challenges ahead for the goal of overturning the law.
Section 1021, I think, poses the greatest challenge to civil liberties in America since the McCarthy era. What Section 1021 did is it would allow the military to put in indefinite detention anyone that, in the government's eyes, were engaged in the following, quote, substantially supporting al-Qaeda or, quote, associated forces of al-Qaeda. So this standard is so nebulous that it can encompass anyone. It can encompass journalists, writers, activists, and in fact, those were precisely the seven plaintiffs that were in this case. We call them the Freedom Seven, and they are Daniel Ellsberg, the legendary Pentagon whistleblower and author of the Pentagon Papers. There is Chris Hedges, the former Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times and currently journalist for Truthdig. There was Noam Chomsky. Another plaintiff is a woman named Birgitta Jonsdottir, who is a member of Iceland's parliament and was associated with the WikiLeaks effort. And then there were three young leaders, Kaiwar Gala, who is one of the founders of Occupy London, Alexa O'Brien, who is a founder of U.S. Day of Rage, which is associated with Occupy Wall Street, and a young leader named Tangerine Boland, who is a founder of a group called Revolution Truth. So those are the plaintiffs that stood up, and I think I described in short order the onerous provision of Section 1021.
Explain to our listeners a bit of what Federal Judge Catherine Forrest based her decision on to call for a preliminary injunction against Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Well, what was so onerous about this legislation is that it would allow any of the group I mentioned before, like our like our plaintiffs, anyone the government deemed to, quote, substantially support al-Qaeda or associated forces. It would allow the government to, number one, place these people in indefinite military detention, quote, until, quote, the end of hostilities, which is potentially forever in the war on terrorism, or try these people in a military court, not a civilian court, where you get to go before a jury of your peers, or render these people to a foreign country. So those are the three things the government could do under this. And what Judge Forrest courageously did was enforce the Constitution and rule that the First Amendment protects all of these people in their activities and protects all journalists in their activities. For now, we have a victory. The government has 60 days to decide whether or not to appeal. Even if they do, it's going to be a long time on this appeal, and during that time span, the injunction will stay in place. Or, and this is what we've been calling on the government to do, it's really high time for the administration to own up to the fact that this statute is wholly unconstitutional. It needs to be expunged permanently. And President Obama, the former constitutional scholar, he understands perfectly well that this is unconstitutional, and he should recognize that by directing his Justice Department to enter into a stipulation that from now that they will accept a permanent injunction against the NDAA. And that's what they need to do. I hope that other federal judges will read this opinion and take stock of what Judge Forrest has done. And also, I think that citizens should understand that you can, and the young lawyers will understand that you can fight the federal government and win in court. It doesn't happen all the time, but it's something you must try to do, in addition to the protests and other activities that we need to take our country back.
As you said, we don't know at this point whether the federal government will appeal this case, and it could take many more months to find out where this ends up. But are you concerned that this case could land before the Supreme Court with its conservative majority and its history of favoring extraordinary measures by the government and military in the war against terrorism?
It would take a while to go up to the court. In the meantime, we have prevailed, but it is a concern. However, it's not an overwhelming concern because Judge Forrest was very good in her opinion in citing Supreme Court precedent that was authored by the conservative justices. For example, she cited Citizens United, which is a case probably familiar to your listeners, which is a very aggressive First Amendment opinion that protects the corporation's right of free speech to spend money on elections. Now, this is a case I do not agree with in the least, but this is actually the first useful citation of Citizens United, I think, ever, because essentially what Judge Forrest was saying is, if you're going to extend maximum free speech rights to corporations, you have to extend them to citizens, journalists, activists, etc. There were a number of citations that Judge Forrest made to opinions by the Supreme Court authored by the Conservative Five that I think will help this opinion stand the test of time.
That was Carl J. Mayer, one of two lawyers representing plaintiffs in a lawsuit challenging indefinite detention provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act. Find links to more information and analysis on the constitutionality of the law by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From the moment plans were announced to hold the NATO Military Coalition and G8 Economic Summit meetings in Chicago during May, peace and economic justice activists began organizing demonstrations to oppose the war in Afghanistan while linking military spending to harsh budget cuts and unemployment. But in March, the White House abruptly changed the location of the G8 summit, moving it to Camp David in Maryland. Undaunted, protest organizers moved ahead with their plans, and thousands of activists arrived in Chicago to greet more than 50 world leaders as they arrived in Chicago for the NATO gathering May 20th and 21st. In a week of actions beginning May 14th, protest organizers with the Coalition Against NATO G8 War and Poverty Agenda held a wide variety of events and protests focusing on war, peace, the environment, and economic inequality. In advance of the week's major protests, Chicago police raided several homes and arrested five activists on terrorism-related charges, citing plans for attacks in the city with Molotov cocktails and other incendiary devices. Civil liberties attorneys and activists decried the arrests for what they declared were trumped-up charges. On the largest day of protests on May 20th, More than 10,000 people marched through city streets toward McCormick Place, where the NATO summit was being held. During an emotionally charged moment on the march, U.S. veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars paused in an act of defiance to throw their medals away in the direction of the NATO gathering. After the march, Chicago police wielded their batons, beating some protesters bloody to clear the streets, living up to their malevolent reputation earned during protests decades earlier at the Democratic National Convention in 1968. Your reporter spoke with Pat Hunt, an organizer with a coalition protesting the NATO summit, who discusses the goals of the week of actions and the reasons behind what appears to be a revival of the nation's long-dormant peace movement.
Well, I was really proud of the people that came out and protested. There were so many actions that happened and so many different causes that came to light on how the policies of NATO and G8 affect people here in the United States. One of the things that we found when we were organizing this, the march and rally on the 20th and the People's Summit the weekend before on the 12th and 13th, was it really gave us an opportunity to have teach-ins and forums and panels and discussion about what NATO and G8 is, which doesn't happen very often in this country and certainly in Chicago, in the Chicago area. So we really got to raise the consciousness of people as to why we should be protesting NATO and G8. And with G8 leaving, we know that protests work. It was just kind of ironic that people with all the money and all the guns were scared of us. So the march and the rally went very, very well. We had a variety of speakers. Our guesstimate is between 10 and 15,000 people, but it's always hard to tell when you hit the streets. And then at the very end, the closing ceremony that the veterans did to return their medals was just beyond moving and really brought home some of the people that are truly affected by NATO's policies and actions around the world, the real damage that can cause. It was what we had hoped for, and it was a culmination of about 9 months' worth of work.
Unfortunately, one aspect of these protests, as we've seen over many, many years, is police repression both before these demonstrations begin and during the demonstrations. Tell us a bit about the arrests that took place before the demonstrations started. At least five of those arrested charged with terrorist-related activities, and then you had a number of people injured on the streets who were attacked by police. We witnessed a lot of sort of very harsh treatment by the police of protesters in many areas of the city over these last few days.
Yeah, that's really been the dark side. During the course of the last week leading up to the weekend, as you said, five people were arrested. The homes were raided. The police arrested had no warrants, and they're being held on $1.5 million bond charged with terrorism and giving aid to terrorist organizations. And one of the things that led to the charges was they confiscated a home beer brewing kit and saying that they were making explosives out of that. And, you know, the city of Chicago would be arresting probably one in five people if they were going to arrest everybody that had a home brewing kit. So it's part of a pattern. It's a part of a pattern of trying to instill fear and uncertainty and be divisive. And it's a tactic that's been used, you know, for over 10 years, probably even longer. Happened at the RNC before the 2008 RNC. It happened in Minneapolis there where people were arrested for very similar charges. So it's happened many times before. And it's a way to try to, as I said, to be divisive and also to repress freedom of speech and freedom to assemble.
Pat, since the 2008 presidential elections, the peace movement in the United States has been fairly dormant. What do you think contributed to the success of getting so many more people out in the streets for this march and rally against NATO in Chicago than we've seen in quite some time?
I think there's a couple things. I think the Occupy movement was a huge part of it. We did a lot of outreach to the Occupy movement here in Chicago, which then did outreach to many of the other Occupies across the country. People came in from all over that identify themselves as with the Occupy movement of one city or another. And I think that the another part of it is that there's an anger when you start seeing the dollars that are spent on NATO, and then you start hearing that they're cutting other services. And I think people are getting fed up. You know, I don't think it's quite at the point where it is at Greece yet, but people are fed up. People want something different. People aren't believing what the Obama administration is saying. And I think the other thing is we worked very, very hard to get a permit, and that permit battle became public, which was really our only option, was to make it public and win in the court of public opinion. And people saw that we were really fighting for their rights as well as for our right to have a permitted march. And I think people wanted to support that. And when they saw how difficult it was and how repressive the city was trying to be, I think it sort of shined a light for folks. And I think it was their way of supporting it.
That was Pat Hunt, an organizer with a coalition protesting the NATO summit. For more information and commentary on the NATO protests and police arrests of activists on terrorism charges, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Days before the Connecticut legislature ended its 2012 session at midnight on May 9th, the State House and Senate passed a landmark education reform bill that is aimed at closing the state's widest in the country racial achievement gap. When elected, Democratic Governor Daniel Malloy declared education reform was his highest priority. But when the legislative session began in February, many players thought he sabotaged the process by sarcastically stating that all teachers have to do to earn tenure is show up for 4 years. That comment provoked the two teachers' unions in the state, the Connecticut Education Association and the Connecticut Federation of Teachers, to actively oppose the governor's proposal. But over the course of the three-month session, educators, legislators, and the governor's team worked to reach a compromise. The resulting bill was passed by a lopsided margin in the state Senate and unanimously in the House. Declaring that education reform is the civil rights issue of our time, Malloy, unlike many other governors around the U.S., is supporting expanded state funding to assist low-income schools and their students, while avoiding teacher layoffs and deep education budget cuts. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Gary Holder Winfield, a Democratic representative from New Haven and chair of the Connecticut General Assembly's Black and Hispanic Caucus, which was instrumental in helping pass the bill. Here, Holder Winfield describes the hurdles that had to be overcome for passage and some of the key points in the education reform legislation.
If you look at the legislation that passed here in Connecticut, the Commissioner's Network, which actually means that schools will be turned around, is important. And I recognize there is a conversation about what happens to teachers. But the reality is you have schools in the state that have been failing for decades. And so they've failed generations of students. When you're in that type of situation, you have to actually make a move. And so the move you make has to think about those who work in that environment, but also has to make a significant change for the students who find themselves there. So I think that's one of the important things. The caucus, the Black and Puerto Rican caucus, that is, had an effort to bring forward a bill separate from the education bill, which ultimately was incorporated in it, that dealt with literacy grade K through 3, because at the root of the achievement gap is a gap in the number of words that minority and non-minority populations enter the school with, and those of means and those without means enter the school with, and that's where the gap is largely resident, at least initially.
Well, what about even before that? What about preschool?
Well, we would love to have had the bill be pre-K through 3, but we don't have universal pre-kindergarten, so we started at kindergarten, at least in terms of titling. But the bill does actually speak to pre-kindergarten where it's available.
But isn't there some significant funding to increase the number of pre-K slots?
Initially, the governor imagined that we would go to 750 slots. The bill that ultimately passed had 1,000 slots for early childhood. So that is a significant increase. Now, the reality is we need probably 5,000 or 6,000 slots, but it's a step forward and a significant step forward. So the answer to that question is a yes.
Gary Holder Winfield, some of the bill is based on the education reform already underway in New Haven with buy-in from the teachers union. The two state teachers unions did not oppose it in the end. What changed in that equation for the teachers unions that they were willing to go along with it?
I think part of the issue here was initially the governor said some things that weren't useful to the debate, and so people weren't listening to each other from the outset. Also, I think it was a huge bill, and there are many people who said they read it, but you could read a huge bill like that and still not understand all that is entailed in it. The other thing is there's some things that you just have to know other laws to know what it means. So when you talk about teacher evaluations, because of Connecticut law, you're not just talking about teachers, you're talking about administrators. So when you hear this discussion about, well, we're only talking about teachers, that's not actually true. So there are a lot of things that factor into why the bill was perceived in a way that might not have been favorable to teachers. Now, that's not to say there weren't parts of the initial bill that teachers would not like or that might not be favorable to them, but I don't think the bill was ever as detrimental as people believe. The other thing is, and this is partially the caucus's input, our bill actually was attempting to say, where there are problems, instead of being punitive, let's figure out simply what the solutions would be and make sure they are in place. So you could have a teacher who's not really at the place where they can teach reading, but instead of saying, well, we're going to punish you for that, what we'll do is we'll make sure that all of the resources are necessary and that you have the opportunity to get better, or eventually, instead of firing you, we just make sure that you don't teach to those children and you get moved somewhere else. And so it's a melding of different perspectives, I think, that made the bill better.
The new law requires that teachers receive a rating of effective to earn tenure, and they would have to receive a rating of ineffective in order to lose tenure. And there's no link between certification, pay, and those evaluations. But what happens if a teacher is deemed ineffective?
There are teachers, and they're very few, but there are teachers who aren't good at what they do. And so what we should be doing is making sure that we capture these teachers by an evaluative process and give them an opportunity to improve. And if they don't improve, we have an expedited process, at least expedited as compared to what we currently have. We begin to work on getting that teacher out of the place where they are.
That was Connecticut Democratic State Representative Gary Holder Winfield. For more information on Connecticut's education reform legislation, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Zelfia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.